and this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio from the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. This is the Peace and Social Justice Program, and this is Laurel Avalon with you today on Peace and Social Justice. The program is presented to you live, and we love to have live guests, most of them by phone, if they're somewhere else across the country or around the world. We've got three such interviews scheduled for today. We'll be up with our first interview in just a minute with Paul Gunter from Nuclear Beyond. Beyond Nuclear, I should say. Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by Trailhead Adventures, serving outdoor enthusiasts on the ridge with apparel, travel wear, footwear, and outdoor gear for all seasons. You can get Trailhead Adventures tech tips, as well as information on upcoming adventures by calling 877-6876. Trailhead Adventures is located in Paradise at 6265 on the Skyway, and find them online at trailheadgear.com, and by Dr. Michael Schuell, clinical psychologist offering psychotherapy for adults and play therapy for children at his office in downtown Chico. Mike can be reached at 891-6292. Stay tuned here for more peace and social justice right after this.
About the water down below and what got lost. Pachinko jingle in space, torpedo beams, comic book violence and escaping steam. Gray-suited businessmen hissing against a wall, cut to crumbling guardrail. Motion car fall. Oh, Tokyo, I never can sleep in your arms. Mine keeps on ringing like a fire alarm.
All right, welcome back to Peace and Social Justice. Laurel Avalon with you today. Good to be with you, and good to have our next guest with us as well. Paul Gunter is with us from Beyond Nuclear. And Paul is going to give us some information from his many years of experience in working on nuclear issues. And should be very timely because of the fact that there's very little information. There was a report on ABC News not too long ago, but mainstream media, so-called mainstream media, has not really picked up on the issue of the Fukushima reactor problem, disaster, catastrophe that has really affected and will continue to affect our world for who knows how long. And so it's kind of being left to social media, and social media has a tendency sometimes to, you know, they have these headlines that are always asking you to guess what you're going to be reading. And sometimes they're very alarming. I found myself being very depressed by some posts on Facebook recently, and I didn't even want to read them. So that doesn't do us any good when we don't get any information. But it also doesn't do us any good when we get incorrect information or information that's sensationalized. So we want to welcome Paul Gunter from Beyond Nuclear to the show today. Welcome, Paul. Whoops. Oh, I think we lost Paul Gunter. Okay, we're going to go back to Bruce Coburn with the Tokyo song, and I will get Paul back on the line.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and let's welcome Paul Gunter to the show today. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
All right, welcome. And tell us what your position is with Beyond Nuclear, if you would.
I'm the director of the Reactor Oversight Project here at Beyond Nuclear.
Tell us a little bit about Beyond Nuclear. What have you been doing? And you've been doing this for quite a while, correct?
Well, I've been involved in the nuclear power issue since 1975 as an environmental activist and energy policy watchdog. Beyond Nuclear has been around since 2007, and we're basically a public advocate for communities looking at nuclear power, nuclear weapons, nuclear waste issues. We are a watchdog on the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and its dealings with the nuclear industry, such as licensing and relicensing of reactors. We troubleshoot a lot of issues, and but we also we've done legal intervention as well in some of these licensing issues. Basically, we are a public advocate looking at the nuclear hazard that comes through the routine operations of nuclear power and the eventual accident.
So the last time we talked to you, Paul, was in October, and that was right before the very treacherous, I should say, operations were going to begin. They were scheduled to begin in November to remove some of the rods from one of the reactors at Fukushima. Tell us how that's going. Is it going?
Well, you know, the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident essentially affected four of the six reactor units that are there. They're all GE Mark I boiling water reactors that were affected by the earthquake and the tsunami. Unit 4 was the one unit that had been shut down when the tsunami hit, whereas units 1 through 3 had been operating. But Unit 4 had offloaded all of its nuclear fuel into essentially an attic fuel storage pond that is 6 to 10 stories up in the reactor building. And it suffered a hydrogen explosion in the aftermath of the accident, and essentially we believe hydrogen gas that was coming from a common venting system off of Unit 3, but it the unit was destroyed and the building is leaning. The company has been trying to shore that up, but we're all concerned that a new earthquake or tsunami could set in motion an event that's much worse than the current accident, and probably much worse than even Chernobyl, because there are about 1,600 nuclear fuel assemblies in that fuel pool, which is very vulnerable, not only because it's elevated, but because the building is damaged. And if it were to fall over, it would be a an open nuclear fire in the atmosphere. TEPCO has been looking to, they started the operation, but...
And TEPCO is the Tokyo Electric Power Company.
Mm-hmm. But the problem is that the information continues to lag behind the events there. So we're pretty much left in the dark in terms of the progress of the offloading of those irradiated fuel assemblies into a much safer, although safe is a relative term in Fukushima, but certainly a storage configurations at ground level or below grade in a common pool that is just about 150 yards from Unit 4, but it's a common pool for all six units that are there. So there's a tremendous amount more radioactive fuel assemblies that are sitting in this under this much larger underground pool very close to Unit 4. But the idea is to get the fuel out of that damaged elevated storage pond into what they call dry cask, which are much more secure, although still problematic because they don't offer any kind of timely solution or barrier to the biological hazard posed by nuclear waste. But it would provide for the compartmentalizing this huge inventory of over 1,500 nuclear fuel assemblies in Unit 4, which would significantly reduce the hazard.
I think one of the problems, Paul, is that this is the problem with the entire nuclear energy industry, isn't it? The problem of, first of all, the potential for natural catastrophes to cause this kind of problem that we have at Fukushima, but also disposing of radioactive materials, waste, and so forth. And that seems to be what's happening here. That's part of it as well. And it's not, there are other kind of Fukushima-like reactors that are in operation all around the world, correct?
Well, we have...
Or right here in the States, at least.
Right. We have 23 of these GE Mark I reactors, just like units 1 through 4, operating around the United States, predominantly in the eastern United States. But, the idea that nuclear power... that an accident can be cleaned up is really a misnomer. I think it's important to understand that we don't really clean up any of these accidents more than we relocate the nuclear contamination. So right now, one of the big problems with Fukushima is there's really no place for the radioactive contamination to go. Plus, the accident has contaminated large areas of land and water. But the idea that every day we have hundreds of tons of radioactive water that's being used,
yes,
to cool the reactor, that... Or being the waste processing facility that was there to clean up that water, just today was announced to have broken down once again. So we have tank farms all over the area there that are growing with hundreds of tons of radioactive water each day, and that water is getting more radioactive. And in fact, current news is that the radiation levels around the fence line at Fukushima Daiichi are significantly higher as time goes on, primarily from the X-rays that are coming off of this 1,000 tanks filled with radioactive water, as well as the ground contamination from the explosions there. But we have three reactors where the reactor cores have melted, and we don't really know, nobody really knows, Tokyo Electric Power, the Japanese government, the nuclear industry, they don't know where those reactor cores are right now. Clearly, they left the reactor vessel in a molten form and have burned their way deep into the bowels of the reactor building. May well have burned through the bottom of the reactor base mat and into the earth. We get reports which have been continuous since the accident of radioactive steam rising off of each of the units periodically, which indicate that they're still thermally hot. They're extremely radioactive, and they're also mingling with groundwater that's moving off of the mountains from behind the Fukushima Daiichi facility, under the facility, into these into the wreckage, the radioactive wreckage, and then draining out into the Pacific Ocean. So we have we have routine radioactive emissions now coming both as atmospheric releases from the wreckage and from the leaking tank farms and from the groundwater that is naturally moving through the radioactive rubble, and all of this is headed into the ocean. So
that's very alarming, because that's really the source of a lot of the posts that I have read on social media, talking about sea stars melting, two-headed whales in Mexico, those kinds of things that are very alarmist, very sensational, as I said earlier. So let's talk about that. What happens when a lot of this radioactive material ends up in the Pacific Ocean? Specifically, for our self-interest here on the West Coast, when is it coming? Is it here? And what is the effect? What are the readings that we should be alarmed about when that radioactive plume that we all hear about arrives, or after it arrives, what should we be looking for?
Well, we just saw a report from the University of California at Santa Cruz and Stony Brook University out of New York that basically have shown that the radiation levels are in fact falling in California from the initial levels that were recorded after the explosions there in March 2011. So the good news is that as far as atmospheric deposition, we're seeing radioactive levels attributed to iodine-131, cesium-137. Those levels are dropping all along the West Coast, at least according to the academic studies that we're seeing. But that needs to be put into context, that the Fukushima disaster is ongoing, and that certainly the big concern about Unit 4, if we had a recriticality accident or drain that fuel pool and a nuclear fire began, it would redistribute radioactivity into the atmosphere. The radioactivity that's going into the ocean is clearly primarily a radiological hazard along the eastern seaboard of Japan, and in fact has shut down the fisheries and the fishing industry. There are fish bans, fish exports bans on these Japanese fisheries. So it's had a very immediate economic impact on the fishery industry there. Given that the radioactivity is still an ongoing routine discharge now, the radioactive levels in the waters off the coast of Japan are now concentrating radioactive cesium, radioactive strontium in biota like algae, plankton, small fish, starting from the very small to all the way up to like bluefin tuna, which have been, we've seen academic studies where the migration of radioactive cesium up through the food chain has been seen now in one of the top level marine predators in bluefin tuna, which spawn off the coast of Japan and migrate over the Pacific and to the, and then they feed off the in California waters. So, you know, there is this movement not only through current but through the marine ecology system, and eventually the radioactivity becomes ubiquitous. It will eventually be everywhere in the Pacific Ocean. The levels at which it will be are yet to be determined, because the accident hasn't ended yet, and we have a very large amount of radioactive material that still is unaccounted for, without any kind of status report from these damaged reactors. I think that you know, we're a big problem is the fact that there continues to be a media blackout on at least you know, that's made more of a problem by the fact that the Japanese government and the nuclear industry are not fully disclosing their activities or misreporting contamination levels. And so rumor and scaremongering, you know, enters into that vacuum. And we have seen a lot of unsubstantiated reports that, you know, essentially panic populations. So
Paul, we need to know where to get information that we can trust, and we also need to know just you know, on the bottom line, Paul Stamets says he agrees with the Suzuki. Another, Paul Stamets is an eminent mycologist, wonderful human being. I just love his work. Says he agrees with a scientist, Suzuki, who says that he eats fish from the Pacific Ocean at this point, as long as it's local to where he is. And Arne Gundersen, another eminent scientist who's worked on this, says that we have to demand that our officials test the fish and make that data public. Do you agree with that?
We'd concur. You know, the Food and Drug Administration right now, along with the Environmental Protection Agency, have essentially stepped down the alert warning system from Fukushima with this accident ongoing. There's never, the U.S. FDA has never been conducted a fish monitoring program, particularly for the northern waters along in the Aleutian Islands and, you know, the northern Pacific. These are early warning signs that should be posted and monitored. We are seeing that you know, even within weeks after the Fukushima accident, the U.S. EPA began to downgrade its atmospheric monitoring systems for radiation potentially coming from Fukushima. But
now, when you say downgrade, you mean that they are not releasing information, they're not collecting it, they are reducing the levels at which it's deemed to be safe. What do you mean by that?
They've reduced the frequency of monitoring, and in fact, they've reduced the number of monitoring stations that are in place along the West Coast for monitoring the ambient, the atmospheric radiation that would and is coming off of that wreckage and blowing out into the Pacific Ocean. So we've seen...
Feel like people really can't trust what information they get from the EPA and from, you know, the governmental agencies. I really don't feel like people feel we're being protected or even informed. So who do we turn to get information about our own safety here?
Well, I'm in our mind, the independent academic sources, have been doing the monitoring, like Stanford University, UC, the University of California Systems, Stony Brook. You know, again, we're seeing trace levels of cesium-137, 134 in bluefin tuna. These are academic studies. But they're commercial fish. So you'd think that the government would be providing us with that level of scrutiny, but in fact, it's coming from private academic institutions. So, you know, we continue to monitor for that level of vigilance that's there, but it's still, below what we believe should be there. The problem is that government and industry, certainly in Japan, by the accounts of their own Japanese Congress, the Japanese Diet, the accident was man-made. It was man-made as the result of the collusion of government, regulator, and industry, which included non-disclosure of ongoing safety issues that were not being addressed, that extreme event of nature then triggered. And those same vulnerabilities that are at Fukushima Daiichi are here in every one of these General Electric Mark I, Mark II boiling water reactors in the United States. And we have the same level of collusion of government, industry, and regulator that have put the financial interest of the industry ahead of the public health and safety and the environment, where electricity generation, production agendas, financial bottom lines, these become more important than the consequences of what they deem a low probability event, that, you know, that when your number does come up. And in an aging industry, it's not a question of if another accident will happen. It's more of when and where. And but this is something, this level of mistrust is part of the history of atomic development, with the many mythologies that have been perpetrated to advance this industry, from the peaceful atom, too cheap to meter, to most recently now being touted as the answer to climate change. But ultimately, this is an inherently dangerous and aging industry where the bottom line rules, and in financial margins and public safety margins are in a constant tug of war.
All right. If you just joined us, we're talking with Paul Gunter from Beyond Nuclear. So, Paul, would you tell us where we can get information that we can trust on the issue of Fukushima specifically? And also, what do we do about the larger issue of the, as you said, aging and inherently dangerous nuclear energy system?
Well, you can certainly go to our website, beyondnuclear.org. We have loads of stories, issues, all connected to references that you can further explore the issues and hazards of nuclear power, nuclear waste, and nuclear weapons. There are a number of other sites. Nuclear Information Resource Service, NIRS.org, the Union of Concerned Scientists, the Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, a lot of the non-government organizations right now are investigating these non-disclosures, what essentially are again, this collusion to keep a happy face on nuclear power globally during this very serious and increasingly dangerous situation, nuclear accident, Fukushima. You know, and also to remember that, you know, we have a similar national sacrifice area out in Ukraine and Belarus from a 1986 nuclear accident that, again, was on catastrophic proportions at Chernobyl. These are all ongoing stories right now as they leave these permanent sacrifice areas, which, in fact, begin at, you know, the very beginning of the nuclear fuel chain, as we see uranium mine tailings left out in all over the world, in from New Mexico to Niger, Africa, to Uzbekistan and Congo. Again, this whole industry thrives on national sacrifice and also it being anti-democratic as well. But the issues of nuclear power are becoming more disturbing as the plants are aging, and what were initially robust margins built into these designs 40 years ago have deteriorated become more, less protection as these plants age are receiving less maintenance and less inspection as they're running the plants hotter and longer as well. So, we have these competing agendas that remain a big concern an industry that runs on a profit motive and therefore cuts corners. And we saw that. We saw the result of corner cutting in Japan. One quick story is, you know, most people don't realize, but the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, when it was originally built in the 1960s, they, in order to economize on the construction, the power plant site was lowered by nearly 80 feet. So they took away the natural tsunami barrier to accommodate for construction vehicles to get in there quicker and easier, to make it less expensive to pump water into the nuclear power stations. But by lowering the plants and the ground level there by 80 feet, they put it below the 50-foot tsunami that came in on March 11th.
Wow.
But we see these kinds of
cutting corners,
shortcuts in every one of these systems, right from the ground up to electrical cabling in nuclear power stations operating in the United States today that was never qualified when it was installed to be in the event of being submerged. We don't need a tsunami. We have many nuclear power plants in the United States that sit below hydroelectric dams or flood control dams, where a structural failure, an earthquake, could create essentially an inland tsunami for nuclear power plants that were never evaluated against that event when they were constructed. Mm. So, these are the kinds of short-sightedness or expedited environmental reviews where construction, you know, build them first, find out later.
Mm-hmm. We are speaking with Paul Gunter. He's the director of the Reactor Oversight Project at Beyond Nuclear. Paul, give us your web. How can we get in touch with, or how can we get more information about Beyond Nuclear again?
Yeah.
What is your website address?
It's www.beyondnuclear.org.
And you have you're on Facebook as well, correct?
Yes,
Beyond,
we are.
There's a Beyond Nuclear site on Facebook.
Yeah, Beyond Nuclear has an active Facebook page.
And I had a person who had suggested Ecological Options Network as another place to get information specifically on the radiation from Fukushima. Any other suggestions for where people could get information specifically on Fukushima besides beyondnuclear.org?
Yeah, there's another site that we work with called Informable. That's E-N-F-O-R-M-A-B-L-E, Informable. And they have a very active website that's thoroughly referenced, so you can get to the background documents on our pages.
Mm. All right. Paul, thank you so much for the information today and for your time today. I know that some people had tuned in at noon expecting to hear Charles Eisenstein, and we went over a little bit. We're going to get Charles on the line here momentarily, but I want to thank Paul so much for the great information that you brought us today. I also would suggest that people go to Paul Stamets, S-T-A-M-E-T-S. He's giving some updates on, this is on Facebook, giving some updates on Fukushima as well that are, you know, reassuring, but you can't really say that you can be totally reassured because this is, as you pointed out, Paul Gunter, this is an ongoing process, sure to intensify to we're going to have to be vigilant for a long, long time about our health as a result of this accident.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul, for being with us.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Okay. Thanks for being with us here on Peace and Social Justice. As I mentioned to Paul Gunter, we're going to have Charles Eisenstein on here in just a minute. Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by EcoCab, Chico's green alternative taxi service. EcoCab provides safe, reliable transportation 24 hours a day in a new, fuel-efficient Toyota Prius. Protect the planet and get to where you need to be with EcoCab, the cab that cares. Call 591-3186. And also by Chico Conservation Voters. For more than 20 years, Chico Conservation Voters has been a grassroots political action committee that has endorsed local, progressive candidates, as well as important environmental and social issues. Chico Conservation Voters will be active in our next election and is proud to support community radio. Look for our Facebook page, coming soon. Be right back here.
The hours grow shorter as the days go by.
Welcome back to Peace and Social Justice. This is Laurel Avalon with you today on Peace and Social Justice, and this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico. So good to get some information on the whole issue of Fukushima from Paul Gunter the project director of the oversight, the reactor oversight project with Beyond Nuclear, and you can get some more information at beyondnuclear.org. Our next guest, I'm very excited to speak with as well. He's a teacher, speaker, and writer focusing on themes of civilization, consciousness, money, and human cultural evolution. So you might remember him from Sacred Economics, but he has come out with another book called The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. I'd love to welcome Charles Eisenstein to the Peace and Social Justice Program.
Hi, thanks, Laura. Lauren,
good to have you with us today, Charles. So, you have been described as, you spoke at a convention or conference where they had, the topic was 25 intelligent optimists. I love that term, an intelligent optimist. Mm-hmm. Is that how you consider yourself?
Oh, I do consider myself an optimist, and sometimes I think I'm intelligent. I think that it's interesting to put those two words together because when you look soberly at the situation, it's pretty hard to think of a rational, practical path from where we are now to a world that's sustainable.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's hard. The optimist heart, I think, is more, I would think the intelligent part might be more difficult to claim. But now I'm thinking maybe the optimist part is more difficult to claim, especially, when you've just spent, 45 minutes talking to someone about radiation coming to the West Coast, and I happen to be on the West Coast. And so give me some help here, if you would, Charles Eisenstein, as a person who works on this, writes about this, what can we do when we're faced with evidence that we don't have a lot to be optimistic about?
Well, the key insight for me is to understand that the reasons that the worldview that makes us powerless or that makes it seem impossible to fundamentally change things and makes it seem like whether it's possible or not, our own individual actions can't make much difference. That whole worldview is the same worldview that generates the destruction on our planet and the social injustice and the war. It would take me some time to really flesh it out, but basically, when we see ourselves as separate and separate from nature, separate from each other, separate from the terrorists, from the criminals, from any of the people that we other, or any of the species or beings or even matter itself that we other, and say that these other beings have less of the properties of a self than we do, less intelligence, less consciousness, or whatever. When we do that, then on the one hand, we naturally adopt an attitude of control toward the world. If we're separate from everything out there, and everything out there has no intelligence or purpose, and doesn't, it's indifferent to our well-being, then our goodness, our security, our well-being comes through controlling these indifferent or hostile forces outside of ourselves. So when we separate ourselves from nature, then we seek to become the lords and possessors of nature, and we have a whole technological system that is geared toward doing that, harnessing the power of the atom, for example. It sounds a little quaint today, but that was what atomic power, now known as nuclear power, was all about. So this attitude of domination and control comes from a position of separation. And that is a recipe for despair when you understand that if the universe operates by impersonal forces, then for one thing, you don't have much force at your disposal. Secondly, the powers that be have way more force at their disposal than all of us progressives or radicals combined. And you know, you can just make a solid case that nothing is going to change. Where I get optimism, and you can interrupt me if I'm going on too long here, but where I get optimism is when I encounter things happening in the world that don't fit into that story of separation, that othering of nature, of other people, of other beings, things that couldn't happen according to what I have grown up in, what I grew up learning about how reality works.
Maybe Charles, you could give us one of the stories from The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, and something that would illustrate how small acts of kindness and trusting our own feelings can make a change, generally, can change attitudes. I really see this as a key toward not burning out as an activist and not feeling the despair or kind of eliminating the despair because we put ourselves in a place where we become powerless when we do that. And I'm very reminded this whole point of your latest book really reminds me of things that are going on in the world that I could think of right now. Respectful Revolution. I don't know if you've gone to their website. They have stories of people making changes, doing positive, respectful acts. And they're small sometimes, but they change attitudes and they change lives. So maybe if you can give us some stories from your book that do the same thing.
I just came across a website that had 12. It's on Guerrilla Translation, which is an awesome website by some Spanish guys. and there's one listing 12. Like this one isn't in my book, but there was one protest that was the police were charging. They were going to attack. You know, it was going to turn violent, and the protesters had this gigantic foil-covered cube.
A mirror. I saw that. That is so cool.
And you know, like, that just completely changes the dynamic. It renders the police almost powerless.
Oh, my gosh. That's a great example.
Yeah, it just breaks the story, you know? One of the things I write about in the book is the power of disrupting the story as a form of activism. We look at whoever it is, the police, you know, or the CEOs or the frackers, you know, the bankers, whoever, and we think, well, they're doing terrible things. Therefore, they must be terrible people. And if they're fundamentally terrible people, then the only way to change them and to stop them from doing what they're doing is to overcome them. That is the mentality of force. And it's a recipe for despair because they control the media, they control the guns, you know, they control the money, they control everything, you know, the prisons, surveillance state. Like, you're not going to overcome them by force. So it's hopeless if that's what you believe. But really, when people do horrible things, it's because they are inhabiting a story, a worldview, a set of interpretations about what things mean that makes those actions seem right to them. And they're just like everybody else, imagining that they're the good guys. So if force isn't going to win, then we have to change the story. So introducing a gigantic mirror cube into a protest kind of disrupts the story that, you know, here are these terrorists out there, you know. It happened in Gezi Park. This is another example that I don't think I have in the book, but a lot of people have heard of the piano player. You know, just when you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the square, the police, there's a deadline, they're supposed to evacuate by midnight or whatever, and the police are massing with tear gas, you know, and all of their riot gear. And then right when they're about to move, they hear piano music. And this young guy basically has carted his piano, you know, into Gezi Park, and he's playing it. And it's somehow, like, the operating story of the police no longer makes sense. Like, this beautiful piano music doesn't fit into the narrative that they were inhabiting, that that justified what they were about to do. Mm. And so these are some examples. And I think on a broader level, you know, they come from a different view of human nature than we're used to, where we have to see everybody as in this together, and even the most rapacious corporate executive or politician as somebody deep down who wants to do the right thing, who has a heart like we do. Like, to me, that is a much more fundamental kind of revolution than merely deposing the bad guys.
So, but there is, I see instances, and maybe I'm confusing things here, but, you know, sometimes you have to step in and stop harm, right? You have to do something that has an element of force to it, because you are stopping someone from, I don't know, killing someone, or you know what I mean? You have to do something that requires that it stop. I can think of an example. There was earlier this week, there was a Facebook post from a local person about a new site on Facebook that was basically bullying local people, naming names and saying just horrible, horrible things about them. You know, just and that it would it already had, like, in a matter of, you know, 18 hours, it had 600 likes on it. And, you know, and how can we stop this? What do we do? How can we stop this? So, you know, a lot of people who were friends told other friends about it. You know how it works, social media. And you go to the site and you see it's just horrible. It's terrible. It's very anti-woman. Most of the victims of the bullying were women, and they were all, you know, called nasty names that women get called. And so we all registered our complaints to Facebook. At first they said, oh, it meets it, you know, your complaints are invalid, this page meets community standards, whatever. There were enough of us who did that where they reversed their decision within a few hours, and that site was gone from Facebook within probably 6 hours. So we were, like, you know, kind of the internet slapping each other on the hands going, yay, we did it, blah blah blah. But, you know, the thing is, the problem is still there. I mean, how do we reach out to whoever it was that thought that was a good idea? I kind of felt, in a way, like we just, like a bully myself, because we shut them down. You know, we kind of curtailed their speech, even though it was horrible speech. We stopped it and put an end to it. But it's not, there's no end. I mean, how do we go further? What do we do to...
Well, I mean, I don't think... there's a few ways to look at that. You could also say that you are changing the story that says that people think that such speech is funny and they approve of it, you know? I find it myself... I think I did say this in the book... I find it much easier to do the right thing when I know I'm being watched. And the internet can perform this function. And so I don't think, like, shutting them down in that way is necessarily an expression of violence. Not 100%. But it's true, like, that guy probably walked away from it just as misogynistic and hateful and feeling probably really persecuted.
Well, maybe, you know, more so because he was shut down. You know, that's your reaction, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that there's never a time to fight, you know, never a time to just try to, you know, address something with an equal or greater force. What I'm saying, though, is that we reflexively react in that way to situations where force or fighting isn't the only or most effective response. I heard a beautiful story from a woman, she's from Ghana, so a month or two ago, and she had just given birth. Her baby was still in her arms, you know, there were still birth fluids, blood, you know, she was just given birth, and three men burst into the house with machetes, small house, they burst in through the door with machetes and made straight for her.
Oh.
Her husband jumped in the way, and the machete came down and hit him in the head, gashed his head open, blood's pouring out. She says she didn't know a human being could have that much blood in them. And then he falls away, and then the man turns to her again, raises the machete, and she is overcome by an incredible sense of calm. She can't even get up. She's so weak from having just given birth. And she asks, she says, "Are you here to kill us, or would you like something else?" And something in her voice just calmed everything down. Like, and they said, "We want the money, the jewels, the computer," you know. And then she just in a very businesslike way said, "Oh, yes, the computer's right there. You'll find a bag over there. You can put it in there. We have another computer in another room," you know. And she just very calmly told them what to do. And they just did it.
Hmm.
Now, that's a situation where she didn't have the option of using force. But when I bring these up, I get story after story of people who either they could use force and they don't, or they're in a situation where they seem helpless but actually find themselves to be very powerful by seeing the aggressor with different eyes.
Mm. Yeah, it's a puzzle as to how that happens. What is the process in which she, for instance, allowed herself? How did she get there? You know, that would be not a normal reaction, I think, or not a typical reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's not normal for us.
We'd be screaming, we'd be pleading, we'd be crying,
right.
We'd be hiding.
It takes a tremendous amount of courage, and I
yes.
think that the times that are upon us are calling for that kind of courage and also calling for nonviolent action. Because, you know, it's like Martin Luther King said, you know, anything that, or I'm paraphrasing, of course, but anything that you do from hate just strengthens the field of hate.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're trying to make people hate the Koch brothers, you know, or
yes.
hate the, right? And your idea is that if you get them angry enough, they'll rise up and do something. So what are they going to do? They're going to, maybe it'll be like Egypt, you know, where they tear down the dictator. But then what? Everybody is in a mentality of the way to solve the problem is to dethrone the bad guy. But that's not, for one thing, it's not an accurate understanding of why people do bad things. And secondly, it's not a constructive approach.
Mm-hmm.
So it's limited as to how much it can't achieve what we need to achieve these days, that's for sure.
Right. If you just joined us, we're speaking to Charles Eisenstein. This is the Peace and Social Justice Program, and this is Laurel Avalon here with you today. Charles is a teacher, speaker, writer, intelligent optimist, and amazing, an analyst, I think, of humanity. So one of the things I liked, Charles, I especially, it talked to me, is this notion of speaking to the choir, because I feel like that's what I do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people who tune into the Peace and Social Justice Program are probably not the same people who listen to Rush Limbaugh or, you know. So,
right.
So I, you know, people, and when we have events where people come and hear a speaker, you know, I get that a lot. I get people saying, "Oh, well, you know, they're just speaking to the choir. It's just the same people that come all the time, blah, blah, blah." I loved your analysis of that speaking to the choir makes more beautiful music together. The more people you have in the choir, you know, choirs are wonderful. And choirs,
yep.
Choirs are like empowering, you know. you have people who feel the same way you do.
Yeah, the more resonant and aligned with each other the choir is, the louder and more beautiful and more attractive to others the music is. And I don't know, like I enjoy, as a member of the choir myself, I enjoy being preached to sometimes by a really good preacher at least, who gets me fired up, you know, and keeps me believing when there's so many forces outside in society that are trying to pull me back into accepting what's presented to us as normal. You know, like you just log onto a website and there's the news, you know, Beyonce, you know, like Kate Middleton, whoever she is, you know, like Kim Kardashian, you know, and like all that stuff says that things are pretty normal. Things are okay. If Fukushima were really that bad, people wouldn't be, you know, the highest number of clicks wouldn't be on the kitten video, you know, or Beyonce or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Right? So we're getting like, we need the preachers. And there's another thing I just thought of right now. Well, I guess this is kind of in the book too, but, you know, the idea, so what's the alternative? You know, well, instead of speaking to the choir, you should go and speak to the people who, you know, who don't agree with you. Well, have you tried that? You know, have you tried speaking to your, I don't know, did you go over the holidays and speak to your brother-in-law or your uncle who listens to Rush Limbaugh? How successful was it? How successful were you in changing his mind with your impeccable logic that you know, proves beyond a doubt that climate change is actually happening? And, like, you know, people don't change. So there's an assumption here that people change their minds when presented with enough logic and evidence that contradicts their beliefs, but they don't.
Hmm. The other thing, too, Charles, is that sometimes you think that it's not the choir listening, that people actually agree with what you're saying, and you're speaking defensively as if they don't, and you're trying to hammer it into them, and then
right.
You know, because you think the louder you say it, the more they'll listen, you know.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's probably the opposite reaction may occur.
And everybody is, at least in some way, part of the choir too.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
to,
right.
It depends on what moment you catch them. You know. I don't know, like, I had this experience. I spoke at a pretty mainstream conference. It was a technology conference. The speaker before me was a vice president of Samsung, and he was waxing eloquent about the golden age ahead when your smartphone will enable you to video conference from the beach, you know, where you're on vacation, and to communicate with your refrigerator at the same time. And I was the next speaker, and I get up there, and I'm like, come on, guys. I said, this is an auditorium of you know, close to 2,000 people. I'm like, come on, guys. Is anybody here really excited about that? You know, like, let's stop pretending. Technology was supposed to be more magical than that. You know, there was supposed to be this marvelous world, the future. And now we're talking about communicating with our refrigerator. And when you're on vacation, still being able to work via video conferencing, like, you know, what about the age of leisure? You know, what about this unfulfilled promise of technology? Come on, guys, am I the only crazy one here? Or does anybody else secretly have a doubt, misgivings?
Hmm.
And I thought that would arouse quite a response, but instead I could hear the crickets chirp.
You mean they did want a refrigerator that talked to them?
Like, I don't know. Maybe they were just so shocked or something. But so it seemed like, and I mean, that was I had a tough time. I, you know, at the end, like, there was just some very tepid, polite applause.
Ah.
And, you know, but afterwards, a few people did, you know, say, thank you for saying that. But it wasn't something that is allowed to be said out loud yet in those circles.
Mm-hmm.
But so even so, though, there's still, I guess, I don't know, maybe I'm contradicting myself in saying that it is important to speak to people who aren't obviously in the choir because it awakens something in them, too. But I also think it's important, you know, even if you're very much in the choir, there's still these doubts, you know, and this loneliness, because our radical views contradict so much of what surrounds us. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have the answer. I mean, on the other hand, you know, this is a peace and justice program, and something like, what is it, 70 or 80% of the American population opposes any of the war, all of the wars that are going on.
Absolutely.
You know, so in a way, like,
that's the real underlying truth, isn't it? And the thing is that those people who oppose, you know, those 80% or whatever, they feel like they're in the minority. And yeah. how has that been achieved? You know, I mean, we're marginalized. We are, you know, there's so many things that we're called because we believe in peace. You know, we believe in, you know, we are opposed to war. We're opposed mm-hmm. to violence. We, you know, we want alternatives to these things. So, you know, why is it that we're walking around feeling like, you know, we're you know, alone?
Well, you know, I can't remember. I read something by some social philosopher or something. He was talking about the mass media and said that their power comes not from everybody believing them, but from everybody thinking that what the mass media says is what everybody believes.
Yes.
But nobody actually believes it. It's like the emperor's new clothes. But it's even more extreme. In the emperor's new clothes, everybody sees him naked, but nobody says it out loud because they'll be thought a fool. And finally, it takes a little boy, a naive person, who's not afraid of being ridiculed, to say it out loud, and then everybody sees the light. Today, though, what happens is you say, hey, the emperor has no clothes, and the person next to you, who also sees no clothes on the emperor, in order to conform to the perceived social norm, will actually criticize you mm-hmm. or distance themselves from you mm-hmm. for having the same weird view that he has.
Mm-hmm.
It's really quite a paradox, and maybe it just hasn't quite reached critical mass, because maybe it just takes more than one little boy. Maybe it takes a lot of people saying it, and maybe it also takes, I mean, it's, you know, there's a whole lifestyle associated with pretending that things are fine, pretending that things are normal. And I think, you know, also what it takes is that whole lifestyle, that whole universe falling apart, which it is. It falls apart every time. I mean, Fukushima is helping normal fall apart. This chemical spill in West Virginia that just happened, you know, state of emergency, 300,000 people are told not to drink, cook, wash clothes, or bathe in the water. The disappearing middle class, you know, the story is falling apart for more and more people. So there's, it just hasn't quite reached critical mass yet. But when it does, things can change overnight.
Mm.
And that's why that's another lesson I've taken from, you know, Taksim Square and all these other movements. They happened without planning, you know. They happened. If you sat down with your coordinating committee and said, "Okay, we're going to bring a million people into the streets. What do we have to do to make that happen?" You wouldn't be able to do it. It's impossible to make that happen according to linear causality.
Mm-hmm.
According to, okay, we need a certain amount of money, a media campaign, yeah, right. That's not going to work. Yet it happened. Incredible things happened almost overnight. You know, and there's a million people. How are you going to feed them? Well, that spontaneously happened. What about toilets? Like, that was spontaneously taken care of. Like, things that you would have to plan for years happened almost by themselves. And so the question becomes, how do you create the deep conditions for things like that to happen?
Yes.
You answer that.
Oh, you don't. I don't know. I mean, it strikes me that, you know, this whole thing of separation, that, you know, where we walk around, and I'm one of those people, we walk around feeling like we are separate from everyone else and from nature, and we don't realize that our inner purpose is to exactly answer that question. And so we aren't prepared for it. And I think that's why it happens so spontaneously, and that's why the critical mass is going to happen spontaneously, mm-hmm. is that, you know, we have to actually think about these issues ahead of time to be prepared for them. And maybe we won't be prepared, but, you know, when it comes, we'll know it, and we will be part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a real answer to that either, but I do think that, and this isn't the only thing that needs to happen, but I do think that the more of a kind of ground state of love and caring and gratitude that we create, the more likely it is that movements like this will be resilient and courageous and not turn violent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes a lot of fortitude to not respond to violence with violence of your own.
Yes.
You know, or not to demonize the police. I mean, it sure can feel gratifying, you know, to gain self-approval by being the victim of police violence or something like that, and to portray them to yourself and to others as these horrible aggressors. But if we're going to win this, the police have to join us. And that's, in the social movements that have been successful, that's what happened. You know, the turning point came when the police said, we're not going to shoot. Or the military said, we're not going to shoot.
Yeah.
And a portion of the elite split off from the rest of the elite and said, yeah, we're giving up. We're not going to hold on. We have to choose. Are we going to hold on tighter and tighter? I heard a documentary about it was around, you know, the time of Mandela's death, and it was about the change in 91, I believe it was, when de Klerk freed Mandela and ended apartheid. And you know, and he was saying, he was being interviewed, and he said, you know, I had a choice, basically. Either it was to hold on even tighter, maybe to, you know, make a few cosmetic concessions, you know, to kind of delay things, but with the goal of keeping apartheid going as long as possible. Either I had to do that, hold on tighter, in other words, or had to let go completely.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided to let go completely. Certainly, that decision was made in the context of international pressure, and even more importantly, the civil disobedience and resistance of the majority of South Africans. But you know, still, he had a choice. You know, and so the question becomes: why? Like, what are the circumstances under which, when you could go either way, you choose the path of peace? You know, how do you create those circumstances? And I ask myself, what makes it easier for me, if I've been in the wrong, what makes it easier for me to admit that and to start choosing differently?
Mm-hmm.
Usually when I feel threatened and attacked, I become more defensive.
Mm-hmm.
But when I feel safe, then it's easier to let go. So I think that it's important to bring humor and generosity of spirit, you know, into our political dialogue more.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
This is the Peace and Social Justice Program, and we're speaking with Charles Eisenstein right now. This is a good time to talk about the Martin Luther King celebration happening here in Chico Sunday, January 19th, starting at 3 p.m. at the downtown City Plaza. There's a march led by children to the Trinity United Methodist Church. A great program is scheduled, including a choir. The Doing It Justice Choir will be performing. There'll be skits. Ma Muse will be performing as well. And then afterwards, there's a Jamaican-inspired dinner and barbecue after the program. Program's at 4 o'clock at the Trinity United Methodist Church. That's at the corner of 5th and Flume Streets here in Chico. And the, again, the downtown City Plaza, the march begins at 3 p.m., led by the children of our area. So, Charles Eisenstein, thank you so much for being with us on Peace and Social Justice. I appreciate the generosity of your time that you have shared with us today. It was something that I really needed. I feel so much better than I did when I got off the phone with the person, with Paul Gunter, about Fukushima. You know, it's always a struggle in terms for me in terms of activism, you know,
yeah.
and the effective activism and effective for me and for, you know, the world and for affecting change. So I really appreciate this discussion. I thought it was very helpful.
I enjoyed it too. You know, I'm not saying not to have our eyes wide open to the horrible things that are happening.
Absolutely.
And to name them too.
Yes.
You know, but naming is one thing and blaming and shaming is something else.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much, Charles,
Thanks.
For being with us today on
Thanks.
Peace and Social Justice. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. We'll be right back here on Peace and Social Justice.
Why do the baby star has enough food to feed the world? Why wouldn't there so many of us? Are there people still alone? Why are the lizards called peacekeepers when there ain't to kill? Why is a woman still not safe when she's in her home? Love is hate, war is peace, no is yes, we're all free. But somebody's gonna have to answer. The time is coming soon. Amidst all these questions and contradictions, there's some who seek the truth. But tell me, why do the babies starve? There's enough food to feed the world. Why wouldn't there so many of us? Are there people still alone? Why are the missiles called peacekeepers when there ain't to kill? Why is a woman still not safe when she's in her home? Love is hate, war is peace, no is yes, we're all free. But somebody's gonna have to answer. The time is coming soon when the blind remove their blinders and the speech to speak the truth. Tell me, why do the babies starve? There's enough food to feed the world. Why wouldn't there so many of us? Are there people still alone? And why are the missiles called peacekeepers when they're aimed to kill? Why is a woman still not safe when she's in her home? Love is hate, war is peace, no is yes, we're all free.
Okay, this is Peace and Social Justice. I do want to let you know about the next happenings with the group that is has been going to Beale Air Force Base. Beale Air Force Base right here in our Sacramento Valley near Marysville, Wheatland. It's the home of the Global Hawk, a surveillance drone. It's the home of the U-2. It's a home of the MC Liberty, at the corner of Ostrom and South Beale Roads near Wheatland, Marysville, from 3 to 5 p.m. on Monday, January 27th. The group who has been going there to basically interact with the rush hour folks, they'll be there from 3 to 5 p.m. Monday, January 27th. They ask you to join them if you wish. Also, 6 to 8 a.m. the next morning, they will be there for the morning rush hour into Beale Air Force Base to basically bring attention to the issue of drones as weapons of mass destruction. So that's, again, Monday, January 27th from 3 to 5 p.m. You can contact Chris Nelson on Facebook if you'd like to join up.
I'm waiting for him. I'm waiting for a miracle. You rub your palm on the grimy pane in the hope that you can see. Like the ones who've cried.
So again, just to remind you about the beloved community celebration in March in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King, happening Sunday, January 19th, starting at 3 p.m. at the Chico City Plaza. There's an opening ceremony and music, and followed by the traditional march to the Trinity United Methodist Church for an inspirational program at 4 p.m. That program is at 5th and Flume Streets, where the Trinity United Methodist Church is. Lots of great things happening. Skits, music, Mamuse, Doing It Justice Choir. Should be a great event. Local people have been really putting a lot of energy and love into this celebration this year. So kudos to those involved in presenting this excellent program. I'm sure it would be very inspiring.
You rub your palm on the grimy pane in the hope that you can see.
And then an email came in from the Food Democracy Now! Folks about the drive. It's an unpublished copy of a report was received by them undercover from Monsanto. It was a copy of a report done by Monsanto and the Grocery Manufacturers Association, a secret plan to try to sneak in a toothless piece of legislation that would eliminate federal mandatory GMO labeling and give the illusion of serious regulation, which that's always how they do it, kind of make it look like they're doing something, but really doing something not necessarily in the interests of others. It would also usurp the state's rights to pass bills regarding GMO labeling. So you might want to go to fooddemocracy.org for more information on that. There is a petition there should you decide that's what you would like to do about that. And peace and social justice has been made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by EcoCab, Chico's green alternative taxi service. EcoCab provides safe, reliable transportation 24 hours a day in a new, fuel-efficient Toyota Prius. Protect the planet and get to where you need to be with EcoCab, the cab that cares. And also by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by Karen Lemke. Karen is an experienced real estate professional specializing in residential property throughout Butte County. She's a proud supporter of KZFR and encourages you to shop local to keep our community strong. To reach Karen about buying or selling a home, call 924-0567. And you want to stay tuned at 1 o'clock for Playing Dead. Bill is in the house here getting ready to bring you some great music from the Grateful Dead. And then at 3 o'clock, Sanjay will be in with Devastation Sounds. So I'm going to play one more song, and then we'll do the community calendar, and we'll see you next time on Peace and Social Justice. I wanted to thank Chris Nelson for filling in, and also Chris Moore Backman. Two Chrises filled in for me during the month of December. Thank you so much. I appreciate doing that. A little break is nice. It allowed me to do kind of family stuff and other things during the month of December. Really appreciated that. So we'll see you next time on Peace and Social Justice.
Wash my eyes that I may see the yellow return to the willow tree. Open my ears that I may hear the river running swift and clear. And bleed
All right.